A biblical worldview seminar is always about applying the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life. One area that comes up in evangelism frequently is the one of slavery. Tonight I'd like to deal with what you've never been told about slavery. Jesus said in John 8:32, "Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Ignoring the ongoing slave trade today, I would like to give A Tale of Two Islands. A Tale of Two Cities is a great story by Charles Dickens. This is A Tale of Two Islands. During President Obama's 2013 visit to Africa, at $100 million, described the most expensive presidential tour ever, he visited Gori Island, across the bay from Dakar, the capital city of Senegal. There he was photographed at the slave fort's famous door of no return. Obama was quoted as saying, "This is a testament to when we are not vigilant in defense of human rights, what can happen?" Yet, while drawing attention to the slave trade that was outlawed over 200 years ago, the West African slave trade across the Atlantic, he was silent on the much larger, ongoing Arab slave trade that still plagues Africa to this day. Anti-slavery societies calculate that at least over 27 million people are victims of slavery today. That's more than the amount of people who were slaves in the days when William Wilberforce was campaigning against it. According to UNICEF, 1.2 million children are trafficked every year, and most trafficking victims are girls between 5 and 15 years of age. Spoke about the whistleblower earlier today. Many of the governments who enjoy most favored nation status with the United States are actually involved in this modern slave trade. In fact, Mauritania, bordering Senegal, just to the north, has over 500,000 slaves amongst the country's population of just over 3 million people. Samuel Cotton, the African-American author of Silent Terror, A Journey into Contemporary African Slavery, reports that the Mauritanian Arabs and Berbers bring their black slaves with them to work in Dakar, even within sight of Gori Island. This is hardly a secret. This is a pretty well-known fact, well-documented. Yet Obama had not one word to say about this ongoing scandal. For foreign consumption and under external pressure, Mauritania has made some half-hearted legislative attempts to outlaw slavery, but these have been described as woefully ineffective, blatantly insincere. In 2011, four Mauritanian anti-slavery activists were sentenced to 6 months in jail for protesting the enslavement of a 10-year-old girl. They weren't arrested for enslaving the 10-year-old girl. They were arrested for protesting the enslavement of a 10-year-old girl. No punishment was ever handed out to the slave owner, and the slave girl disappeared. President Obama hypocritically stated that his visit to Gori Island, a World Heritage Site, gives me even greater motivation in terms of human rights around the world. Really? Africans find that statement hard to take seriously, considering that Obama had not one word to say about the ongoing 1,400-year Arab slave trade. Although Obama made a major point of visiting Gori Island and condemning the transatlantic slave trade, which ended over two centuries ago, he showed no interest in visiting Zanzibar, the most notorious slave island in history, on the east coast of Africa. Notice this is a map of medieval, Middle Ages, slave routes, all across the Sahara, all the way across East Africa, up the Nile, up the Red Sea, even into the Persian Gulf, Indian Ocean, and so on. Although Obama's second state visit to Africa was Tanzania, he never ventured near the island of Zanzibar, although over 20,000 African slaves were processed every year through then. Now just have a look for a moment at this picture. This is a classic picture of how the camera never lies. Notice this cameraman in the foreground. He's kneeling down to get a from lower picture of President Obama walking, apparently unconcerned about his personal safety, shaking hands to the left and to the right amongst a crowd of adoring Tanzanians. Okay, but this is a wide-angle lens. What do we see? Oh, this three deep group, they've all got the same clothes, the same hats, and they alternately have Tanzanian flags or American flags, and behind them is a row of American and Tanzanian security and military watching over them. They doubtless all went through metal detectors, all processed. This is rent-a-crowd. And this picture of the red carpet treatment is purely to give a false impression. I mean, wow. Perhaps he was concerned not to embarrass his Muslim friends who are still involved in the slave trade today. Also, a visit to Stone Town on Zanzibar would have been even more embarrassing, as the former slaves, after having been liberated by the Royal Navy, Britain's Royal Navy, they built a magnificent church, actually a cathedral, over the old slave market with the pulpit and altar by where the auction block and whipping post had stood. The Anglican Church, Christ Church, in Mukunzini Road, in the centre of the old town, occupies the area which used to be the largest slave market of Zanzibar, where they used to situate it. And the construction of this cathedral was intended to celebrate the end of the Arab slave trade on Zanzibar, inspired by the testimony and the life's work of David Livingstone, which Henry Morton Stanley had broadcast after finding him in Africa in 1871. The altar and the pulpit were designed to be in the exact place where the main auction block and whipping post had been. Construction of Christchurch began 1873, the year of the death of David Livingstone, missionary explorer. The cathedral was completed and consecrated in 1903. Inside the church, there is a cross made from the wood of the tree under which David Livingstone's heart was buried in Chitambas village in northern Zambia. Near this church, a striking monument has been constructed above the ground, above the 15 underground cells where slaves in transit were incarcerated until their sale to the Arab masters. This monument in Stone Town consists of five stone figures in a pit representing the captured slaves who appear to be rising out of the earth. The shackles around their necks and the chains between them testifies to their plight. They look tired and sad, but strong. Africans are asking why Barack Hussein Obama, an African-American president, continued to be so supportive of radical Muslim regimes who are still engaged in slavery today. Why is he so silent about the largest and longest slave trade in history, one that has not yet come to an end? The comparisons and the contrast between Gori Island and Zanzibar Island are striking. While the European involvement in the transatlantic slave trade to the Americas lasted for just over three centuries, the Arab involvement in the African slave trade has lasted 14 centuries, 1,400 years. And in some parts of the Muslim world, it's still continuing to this day. While two out of three slaves shipped across the Atlantic were men, the proportions were reversed in the Atlantic Islamic slave trade in East Africa, the Indian Ocean across the Sahara. Two women for every man were enslaved by the Muslims. While the mortality rate for slaves transported across the Atlantic were as high as 10%, that's 10% of slaves could die en route across the Atlantic. The percentage of slaves dying in transit across the Trans-Saharan East African slave trade was between 80 and 90% died. The survival rate was barely 10%. While almost all of the slaves shipped across the Atlantic were for agricultural work, most of the slaves destined for the Muslim Middle East were for sexual exploitation as concubines in harems and the men for military service. While many children were born to slaves in the Americas, and millions of their descendants are citizens in Brazil, Jamaica, Haiti, and the USA to this day, very few descendants of the slaves that end up in the Middle East survived. While most of the slaves who went to the Americas could marry and have children and families, most of the male slaves destined for the Middle East slave bazaars were castrated, and most of the children born to the women were killed at birth, either by drowning or by having their throats cut to maintain Arab numerical supremacy. This is after the first slave revolt. They decided we're not going to allow the slaves to ever outnumber us, and we're going to make sure we kill their children. Otherwise, they might find themselves outnumbered. It is estimated that possibly as many as 11 million Africans were transported across the Atlantic. And it might be a surprise to you to hear that 95% of the Africans who went across the Atlantic went to South and Central America, mainly to Portuguese, Spanish, and French possessions. Less than 5% of the slaves that crossed the Atlantic went to the United States. Actually, it's 4.4% went to North America. And that's interesting because that's not the impression you get from Hollywood or school textbooks. However, at least 28 million Africans were enslaved by Muslims, and as at least 80% of those captured by the Muslim slave raiders were calculated to have died before reaching the slave markets, it is believed that the death toll from the 14 centuries of Muslim slave raids into Africa could have been well over 112 million. When you add to that number those sold in the slave markets, the total number of African victims of the trans-African, trans-Sahara, East African, Indian Ocean slave trade would be significantly higher than 140 million people. 140 million. While Christian reformers spearheaded the anti-slavery abolitionist movements, with Great Britain mobilizing the Royal Navy throughout the 19th century to intercept slave ships, set the captives free, there's no comparable opposition to slavery within the Muslim world. We had a contribution to producing this book, The Royal Navy versus the Slave Raiders, Slave Traders, Enforcing Abolition at Sea, one of the most extraordinary achievements in history when a country mobilized their navy for nearly a century to set captives free. Absolutely phenomenal. While Britain outlawed the slave trade in 1807, and the eight main powers of Europe outlawed the slave trade in the Congress of Vienna in 1815, Saudi Arabia and Yemen only outlawed the slave trade in 1962. That's in my lifetime. And Mauritania only outlawed it in 1980. However, Malcolm X, a convert to Islam, noted during his pilgrimage in 1968, he saw black slaves being sold in Mecca 6 years after they'd outlawed the slave trade. It's still going on. The ongoing slave trade in Mauritania is well documented, as is the slave trade in Sudan and other parts of the Muslim world, and I've documented that as well. Apparently, these inconvenient facts did not merit US President Barack Hussein Obama's attention. And rather than using his visit to Africa as an opportunity to draw attention to the ongoing slave trade, like in Sudan, Mauritania, he was satisfied with sermonizing about the need to be vigilant in defense of human rights on what ended over 200 years ago. But he remained shockingly silent on the hideous abuse of human rights taking place right now in countries with whom America has most favored nation status, like Saudi Arabia. Those who want to know the rest of the story, which apparently Obama and much of the mass media and Hollywood would prefer to ignore, I produce Slavery, Terrorism, and Islam, the Historical Roots and Contemporary Threat, to expose the shocking facts. This book is a well-illustrated, thoroughly documented response to the relentless anti-Christian propaganda that has been generated by Muslim and Marxist groups and Hollywood filmmakers. As Karl Marx declared, the first battlefield is the rewriting of history. It's so important to know the past. Slavery, Terrorism, and Islam, the Historical Roots and Contemporary Threats has already gone through 3 editions and 5 printings. The first one earned me a death threat, fatwa, all kinds of death threats. And as a result, I produced a 2nd edition, it was double the size, and a 3rd edition, it was treble the size. And I thought, if they appreciate so much, we're going to keep increasing it. With 300 pages, over 200 pictures, this edition is now 3 times the size of its original, which earned me the death threat fatwa from Muslim radicals. You can access our Slavery, What You've Never Been Told PowerPoint through SlideShare on our frontlinemissionsa.org website and listen to the full Slavery, What You've Never Been Told on sermonaudio.com. We've also produced the Muslim Evangelism Workshop MP3 and helped to produce the Islam Rising DVD series, which is a 4-part series to show to churches on Sunday evenings or midweeks, about from 35 to 40-something minutes each one, and then there's a whole lot of extra bonus from Muslim terrorists and others who've been converted to Christ. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Instead of speaking out against the ongoing Islamic slave trade in Africa, President Obama appeared to have given his highest priority to promoting the radical pro-abortion, pro-homosexual agenda. He talks about gay rights, but gays have always had the same rights as everyone. They've got the rights to vote, they've got the right to property, they've got equality before the law. Gay rights is not about gay rights, it's about privileges for perverts. They already have the same rights. Pro-family advocates complain of the arrogant and often bullying manner and insensitivity of the US State Department against pro-life and pro-family administrations in Africa. Marriage is between one man and one woman. That's not what the American State Department seemed to think under Obama. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and Deputy President William Ruto slammed Obama's remarks, declaring, "This country, the country of Kenya, is a God-fearing country. Homosexuality is illegal in Kenya." An Anglican bishop in Kenya declared, "People who have ruined their own country should not presume to come here and lecture us on the way forward." Well said. In April of 2013, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, embarked on one of the most shocking abuses of U.S. taxpayers' money. They announced that they'd be spending $11 million to train homosexual activists in other countries, mostly African countries. The Washington Blade, D.C.'s gay newspaper, praised Obama's administration for creating an army of international lobbyists for same-sex marriage, anti-discrimination laws, and homosexual rights or privileges for perverts around the world. And they said that the first phase was to focus on developing nations that opposed homosexuality. The 54 countries in Africa that oppose homosexuality. Look at the map. Only one country in the continent of Africa has privileges for perverts. That's South Africa. That's the gay agenda pushed by the ANC under Mandela. They put it into the constitution, the first country in the world to have this in the constitution, sexual orientations. All the rest of Africa is apparently wrong, and they need to be put right by these gay gospel evangelists of the gay lobby from America. This is what they think of Africa. They couldn't care less about our standards. All of this is just a cover, a smokescreen for revolution. Many in Africa have described Obama's presidency as a bitter disappointment, and his Nobel Peace Prize in 2009, almost the moment he became president, before he'd even done anything, as the most cynical Orwellian meaningless gesture. Steve Friedman, the director of Rhodes and Universities and Johannesburg Universities, declared, "I don't think that it's unkind that he has done absolutely nothing for this continent." In some respects, George W. Bush did more for Africa than Barack Obama. I cannot remember an American administration that has shown less interest in this continent than this one. One of the first official acts of George W. Bush, after being elected U.S. president, was to defund Planned Parenthood's abortions overseas. I see that that's what Donald Trump has done too. But one of President Barack Hussein Obama's first acts as president was to refund Planned Parenthood abortions in Africa. So, because of Barack Obama's pro-abortion policies, many hundreds of thousands, possibly millions, of black babies have been killed in Africa through abortion paid by U.S. taxpayers' money. So interesting, Trump and Bush saved lives in Africa, Obama took lives in Africa, or funded it, and who's praised by the average liberal as a friend and hero of the poor? It's absolutely bizarre. It's like George Orwell's 1984, where right is wrong and wrong is right and light is darkness and so on. I don't know, how many would have read the book 1984, George Orwell's 1984? The Ministry of Plenty organized rationing and starvation. The Ministry of Peace dealt with war. The Ministry of Love, they did the tortures. Everything's twisted, and in fact, that's where we are right now. We've got a world which is upside down, back to front, and the villains are victimized and the victims are villainized. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord and so bring wrath on yourself from the Lord? The Lord has called us to be bold and brave and straightforward. Bringing out this book in 2005 definitely brought my life more death threats than I'd ever accumulate up till then. But we keep bringing out more because it's important not to be cowards and not to back down. It's important that we understand Islam, that we understand it and that we help other people to understand. This is the biggest block of unreached people in the world. This is the greatest block of persecutors of the church. This is the greatest threat to Christianity. since the fall of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain, Islam remains as the greatest threat to the world today. And so it's vital that we know, like this map shows you, how, yes, most of the slave trade is always within Africa and into the Muslim Middle East. And we've looked at some of the contrasts in the captivity, and interesting to see the difference between the Western captivity, which gets most attention, but which was light years better than the treatment that they received under Islam. You can think of how many descendants of slaves, children born in the Americas, have ended up in high office. But can you say the same in the Muslim Middle East? Can you name one? The viciousness with which they treated the slaves in the Middle East, like castrating all the males, killing all the children, it's absolutely phenomenal. These are just some of the pictures. But where are the Arabic abolitionists? I mean, we can point to David Livingstone's, William Wilberforce's, Dr. Kirk's, Henry Morton Stanley's. Where on earth can they point to any of their people who fought against slavery? Nearly 100 years after President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in America, and 130 years after all slaves within the British Empire were set free by parliamentary decree, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Mauritania in 1980 begrudgingly removed slavery from their statute books, even though this was only because of international pressure, and plainly it wasn't true because they still do it there anyway. Interesting, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia's capital, had slavery till 1942. Now, you see this picture here. This is of the South African Springbok Legion who liberated Abyssinia, what today is Ethiopia, from the Italians in 1941. And in 1942, before leaving and handing over to Emperor Haile Selassie, they abolished slavery in Ethiopia. So slavery is totally legal in Ethiopia and practiced until the South Africans abolished it in 1942. Interesting, that's not in most of our history books today. Saudi Arabia had slavery officially on its statute books till 1962. Peru abolished slavery only in 1968. India had slavery on the statute books till 1976, and they still practice it. Mauritania till 1980, and they still practice it. One-sixth their population. Before the coming of Christ, the heathen nations despised manual work, and they confined it to slaves. But when Christ was born, half the population of the Roman Empire were slaves. Three-quarters of the population of Athens were slaves. Slavery was indigenous to African and Arab countries before it made its way to Europe. Slavery was widely practiced by all the tribes of the American Indians long before Christopher Columbus set foot on the shores of the New World. What is also seldom remembered is many black Americans in the 19th century in America owned slaves. For example, according to the United States Census of 1830, in just one town of Charleston, South Carolina, 407 free black Americans owned slaves themselves. And the Christian roots of liberty need to be seen. Jesus Christ revolutionized labor. When he took up the axe and the saw and the hammer and the plane, our Lord endued labor with a new dignity. Christianity undercut slavery by giving dignity to work. By reforming work, Christianity transformed the entire social order. Our Lord Jesus Christ began his ministry in Nazareth with these words, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me," to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and release to the oppressed. When the Apostle Paul wrote to Philemon concerning his escaped slave, he urged him to welcome back Onesimus, no longer as a slave, but as a dear brother, as a man, and as a brother in the Lord. That's radical talk. Because of these and other scriptural commands to love our neighbor, to be good Samaritans, to do to others what we'd want them to do unto us, Christians like William Wilberforce, John Newton, William Carey, David Livingstone, Lord Shaftesbury, General Charles Gordon, and many others worked tirelessly to end the slave trade, to stop child labor, to set the captives free. From the very beginning of the Christian church, Christians have freed slaves. During the second and third centuries, many tens of thousands of slaves were freed by people converted to Christ. Saint Melania is said to have emancipated 8,000 slaves. Saint Ovidius freed 5,000 slaves. Chromatius freed 1,400. Hermes, 1,200. Many of the Christian clergy at Hippo under St. Augustine freed their slaves as an act of piety. In AD 315, the Emperor Constantine, just 2 years after he had issued the Edict of Milan, the Edict of Toleration, legalizing Christianity, imposed the death penalty on those who would steal children to bring them up as slaves. So, kidnapping for slavery, death penalty. The Emperor Justinian abolished all laws that prevented the freeing of slaves. St. Augustine of Hippo saw slavery as a product of sin and contrary to the divine plan, as he put out in his great book, City of God. St. Chrysostom in the 4th century taught that when Christ came, he annulled slavery. He proclaimed, in Christ, there is no slave. Therefore, it's not necessary to have a slave. Buy them. After you've taught them some skill by which they can maintain themselves, set them free. For centuries throughout the Middle Ages, bishops and church councils recommended the redemption of captive slaves. And for 5 centuries, the Trinitarian monks redeemed Christian slaves from Muslim servitude. In 1102, the London Church Council outlawed slavery and the slave trade. By the 12th century, slaves in Europe were rare. And by the 14th century, slavery was almost extinct, unknown on the continent of Europe, or Christendom as they called it. But the Islamic slave trade resuscitated it. With the birth of Islam came a rebirth of the slave trade. Ronald Segal, who's a friend of Islam and not a friend of Christianity, wrote the book Islam's Black Slaves. He documents, when Islam conquered the Persian Empire and much of the Byzantine Empire, including Syria and Egypt, in the 7th century, they acquired immense quantities of gold. They stripped the churches and monasteries, either directly or by taxes, payable in gold. They imposed this on the clergy, and they looted gold from the tombs, the pyramids, and so on. And the state encouraged a search and sanctioned the seizure in return for a fifth of the funds. You could steal anything you like under Islam, as long as a fifth comes to the mosque. Segal notes, female slaves were acquired in considerable numbers for musicians, singers, and dancers. Many more were bought for domestic workers, and many were in demand as concubines. The harems of rulers could be enormous. The harem of Abdul Rahman III in the 10th century in Cordoba contained over 6,000 concubines. The one in the Fatimid Palace in Cairo, twice as many, 12,000. Islam's black slaves reveals the castration of male slaves was commonplace. The caliph in Baghdad at the beginning of the 10th century had 7,000 black eunuchs and 4,000 white eunuchs in his palace. It is also noted that homosexual relations were widespread as well. Islam's black slaves notes that the Islamic teachers throughout the centuries consistently defended slavery, for there must be masters and slaves. Just in the 19th century, for which we have the best records, the most accurate records, 1.2 million slaves were brought down the Sahara into the Middle East, 450,000 down the Red Sea, 442,000 from East African coastal ports. That's a total of 2 million black slaves just in the 1800s. At least 8 million more were calculated to have died before reaching the Muslim slave markets. That's 10 million victims just in the 19th century. Islam's black slaves records in the 1570s, a Frenchman visiting Egypt found many thousands of blacks on sale in Cairo on market days. In 1665, Father Antonios Gonzalez, a Spanish-Belgian traveler, reported seeing 800 to 1,000 slaves on sale in Cairo on a market day. In 1796, a British traveler reported a caravan of 5,000 slaves departing from Darfur. In 1838, it was estimated that 10,000 to 12,000 slaves were arriving in Cairo each year. Just in the Arabic plantations off the east coast of Africa on the islands of Zanzibar and Pemba, there were 769,000 black slaves registered. In the 19th century, the East African black slave trade included 347,000 slaves shipped to Arabia, Persia, and India, 95,000 slaves shipped to the Arab plantations in the Mascarmi Islands. One caravan with 3,000 proceeding from the coast in East Africa lost 2/3 of their number due to starvation, disease, and murder. In the Nubian desert, one slave caravan of 2,000 slaves literally disappeared as every slave died. Here's an eyewitness account from Captain Leon of the Royal Navy in 1818. He You report that the Al-Makani in Tripoli waged war on all its defenseless neighbors and annually carried off 4,000 to 5,000 slaves. A piteous spectacle. The poor, oppressed beings were, many of them, so exhausted as to be scarcely able to walk. Their legs and feet were much swelled, and by their enormous size, they formed a striking contrast with their emaciated bodies. They were all borne down with loads of firewood. Even poor little children were worn to skeletons by fatigue and hardships. They were obliged to bear their burden, while many of the inhuman masters, with dreadful whips suspended from the waist. All the trader speaks of slaves as farmers do of cattle. The defenseless state of the Negro kingdoms to the southward are temptations too strong to be resisted. A force is therefore annually sent to pillage these defenseless people, to carry them off as slaves, to burn their towns, to kill the aged and infants, to destroy their crops, to inflict upon them every possible misery. All slavery is for an unlimited time. None of the owners ever moved without their whips, which were in constant use, drinking too much water, bringing too little wood, or falling asleep before the cooking was finished, was considered nearly capital crimes. It was in vain for these poor creatures to plead the cause of being tired. Nothing could withhold the application of the whip. Records from Morocco in 1876 show the market prices for slaves varied from £10 to £30. Female slaves comprised the majority of sales, with attractive virgins fetching £40 to £80. Reported that a considerable majority of the slaves crossing the Sahara were destined to become concubines in North Africa, the Middle East, and occasionally further afield. What very few people are aware of is the Christian slaves of Muslim masters. Seagull also observes that white slaves from Christian Spain, Central and Eastern Europe were also shipped into the Middle East and served in the palaces of rulers and establishments of the rich. He records that all Slavic eunuchs were castrated in that region, and the operation is performed by Jewish merchants, presumably because they do circumcisions. Historian Robert Davis, in his book Christian Slaves, Muslim Masters, White Slavery in the Mediterranean, Barbary Coast and Italy, estimate that North African Muslim pirates abducted and enslaved more than 1 million Europeans between 1530 and 1780. These white Christians were seized in raids which depopulate the coastal towns of Sicily to Cornwall. Thousands of white Christians in coastal areas were seized every year to work as galley slaves, laborers, concubines for Muslim slave masters in what today is Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya. Villages and towns on the coast of Italy, Spain, Portugal, France were the hardest hit. But the Muslim slave raiders also seized people as far afield as Britain, Ireland, and Iceland. They even captured 130 American seamen from ships which they boarded in the Atlantic between 1785 and 1793. Do you know the biggest budget of the first two American administrations? Now we're talking about George Washington and John Adams, was paying bribes to Muslim pirates not to seize American seamen. It comprised 80% the federal budget, and it was Thomas Jefferson who ended that practice by launching the Marines across to the shores of Tripoli to burn their ships and set free the captives. According to one report, 7,000 English people were abducted between 1622 to 1644, many of them ship crews and passengers. But the corsairs, or Barbary pirates, also land on unguarded beaches at night to snatch the unwary. Almost all the inhabitants of Baltimore in Ireland were captured in 1631 under the worthless rule of King Charles I, who didn't do anything to protect his people. There were other raids in Devon and Cornwall. Many of these white Christian slaves were put to work in quarries, building sites and galleys, and endured malnutrition, disease, and mistreatment at the hands of their Muslim slave masters. Many of them were working for public works like building harbors. Almost everything in North Africa was built by white European Christian slaves. Female captives were sexually abused in palace harems. Others were held as hostages and bargained for ransom. The most unlucky ended up stuck and forgotten out in the desert in some sleepy town such as Suez or in a Turkish Sultanate galleys, where some slaves rode for decades without ever setting a foot on shore. Professor Davies calculates that up to 1.25 million Europeans were enslaved by Muslim slave raiders between 1500 and 1800 in those three centuries. And this is what most people forget, is that's why Europe got involved in Africa, to stop the slave raids from Algeria and Morocco and Tunisia and Libya. They first took the ports and then a bit further, and it just led into trying to suppress the slave threats. It is extraordinary that considering that less than 5% of all transatlantic slaves ended up in North America, that the vast majority, if not all, the books, films, articles concerning the slave trade concentrate only on the American involvement in the slave trade. One good film on this is Amistad, which has a very powerful gospel presentation and ends with an extremely uplifting Royal Navy raid on a slave port and setting the captives free. It's as though slavery was a uniquely American aberration. That's the impression you get from Hollywood and the school textbooks. However, the vastly greater involvement of Portugal and Spain and France seems to be largely ignored. Why? Because they're Catholic? Even more so, the far greater and longer-running Islamic slave trade to the Middle East has been ignored so as to make it one of the best-kept secrets of history. We tend to focus on what happened in North America because the United States would ultimately fight a war in part over slavery, and because of the enormous and vocal American opposition to slavery. But this was in sharp contrast to the indifference that most Muslims and Europeans have evidenced towards it. Same thing with abortion. You might get the impression that America is the biggest abortion state in the world, but Russia aborts about 7 million a year. At least it did under the Soviet Union, maybe less now. China aborts about 60 million a year. And so one tends to forget that the reason why we hear about the American slave trade and the American abortion rate is because they're the main ones fighting it and publicizing it because they're opposing it. And the others, who don't care, you don't hear about it in the communist Muslim world because they do it without a peep of opposition. In fact, as President of Benin pointed out some years ago, everyone in Africa is a descendant of those who are both victims of the slave trade and descended from slave traders, slave raiders themselves. It is a fact of history that almost every tribe in Africa, I should say every tribe, but maybe there's a tribe we don't know about, practice slavery. As part of their criminal justice system, they enslaved neighboring tribes as well. The Yao people of Malawi carried out slave raids on the Bemba and Chichewa people of Zambia. The Madagascans enslaved the Mozambicans. The Ovambo enslaved the Bushmen. In fact, South Africa had a Bushman's battalion, 3-1 battalion, first 201 battalion, 3-1 battalion, made up of Bushmen. I think there were thousands of them. They were very effective soldiers. And I had a friend who was an officer there, and he said they had to do everything they could to protect the Ovambos because when they were captured, the Bushmen were not inclined to let them live. And to try and allow them to save the lives of these SWAPO terrorists that have been captured, the South African officers had to go to extraordinary lengths. And they weren't always successful because the Bushmen have been hunted like wild animals for sport and abused and oppressed and exploited and enslaved for centuries. And when the war came, they saw this as an opportunity. Join the South African army, get back at the Ovambo. The Matabele enslaved the Shona people. The Congolese tribes enslaved the Pygmies and still do. In Lawsiland, eastern Zambia, the paramount chief of the Barotse only abolished slavery in 1906 as the British required. He applied, please make us a protectorate. And the British said, we will only do it if you abolish slavery first. And so finally slavery was abolished in 1906. I've been in the Livingstone Museum in Zambia, where you can actually see the King's Declaration of 1906 abolishing slavery in Lawsiland or Barotseland. The legends of European slave raiders venturing into the jungles of Africa to capture free peoples are just that. They're legends. The embarrassing fact of history is that Europeans did not have to use any force to obtain any slaves in Africa. Slaves were sold by their black owners, by chiefs in many cases. There was no need for slave raiders, slave traders, to risk their lives to venture into the jungles of Africa. They simply purchased the people from African chiefs and Muslim slave traders at the coast. That's the shocking fact of history. Many chiefs found it more profitable to sell their enemies, their criminals and their debtors, rather than kill or imprison them. Many were weaker neighboring tribes conquered for the express purpose of selling the people into slavery. There's a lot of money in this. The disgraceful fact is that there were three equally guilty partners in the crime of the transatlantic slave trade. There were pagan African chiefs, there were Muslim Arabs, and there were Christian Europeans. Mostly, African chiefs sold their own people or engaged in wars or slave raids against neighboring tribes to capture victims for this trade. Often, professional Arab slave traders provided the victims. The Middle Passage transported slaves to the West Indies. Here, the slaves are sold, and the ships are loaded with spice and rum and molasses and sugar. And the third leg of the journey was the return to England. So this is what they called the Triangular Passage. Or there was the first passage in England. They loaded up manufactured goods, went to Africa. Second passage was from Africa to West Indies, where the slaves were transported. That's the Middle Passage. That's what the English people didn't see. And then the English people saw the sugar, cotton, and tobacco coming back from West Indies. So as far as they could see, we make manufactured goods and we get back sugar, cotton, and tobacco. The average European on the streets were kept in the dark as to what was actually happening on the Middle Passage. Until in 1785, Thomas Clarkson's landmark book, Slavery and the Commerce in the Human Species, was first published in Cambridge. And that launched William Wilberforce's war against slavery. On Sunday, 28th of October, 1787, William Wilberforce wrote in his diary, "Almighty God has set before me two great objectives, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of society." For the rest of his life, William Wilberforce dedicated his life as a member of Parliament to opposing the slave trade and working for the abolition of slavery throughout the British Empire and beyond. On the 22nd of February, 1807, 20 years after he first began his crusade, in the middle of Britain's terrible war with France, Wilberforce and his team's labours were rewarded with victory by an overwhelming 283 votes for and 16 against. The motion to abolish the slave trade was carried in the House of Commons. The parliamentarians leapt to their feet with great cheers and gave Wilberforce the greatest and most emotional ovation ever seen in British history. William bent forward in his seat, his head in his hands, tears of gratitude streaming down his face. In 1809, the British government mobilized its navy to search suspected slave ships, even foreign vessels on the high seas. In 1810, the British Parliament declared slave trading a felony punishable by 14 years hard labor. In 1814, the British representative at the Congress of Vienna insisted on the abolition of the slave trade being included in the international treaty. The obstructionism of some was swept aside when Napoleon returned from Elba and proclaimed the abolition of the slave trade, no doubt a bid to earn British favor. In that, Napoleon failed, but when Louis XVIII was restored by British arms at Waterloo, British and German arms, actually, he had no choice but to confirm Napoleon's gesture and to bow to British pressure. And so a declaration of the eight powers of Europe, including Russia and Sweden and Prussia or Germany, France, Netherlands, Austria, and Great Britain, to abolish the slave trade as swiftly as possible. This was annexed to the final treaty of the Congress of Vienna, 9th of June, 1815. So Europe abolished the slave trade in 1815. That, by the way, is over 200 years ago. In 1825, Britain passed a bill making slave trading punishable by death. Finally, just 3 days before William Wilberforce died, by an act of Parliament in 1833, the British abolished slavery itself, setting all 700,000 slaves in the British overseas territories, mostly Jamaica, free. Wilberforce's lifetime campaign was now fully successful. Thank God that I've lived to witness the day in which England is willing to give £20 million for the abolition of slavery. Within 3 days, he died rejoicing. And that's just some of the story. There's a whole chapter on William Wilberforce, missionary to Parliament in the greatest century of missions. In the history of European morals, they suggest that the unwary, unostentatious, glorious crusade of England against slavery may probably be regarded amongst the three or four perfectly virtuous pages comprising the history of nations. In other words, never before had a nation given so much of its blood and treasure to set total strangers free in other countries. The abolition of slavery is one of the great turning points in history, and the long, vigorous crusade of the Royal Navy throughout the 19th century against the slave trade ranks as one of the most extraordinary, unselfish applications of national policy ever seen in the history of nations. That's a pirate ship going up and bombarding off Tripoli, and Admiral Peregrew finding that there's nothing the Muslims respect more than strength. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. During Livingston's travels, he exposed another slave trade. While the Royal Navy was defeating the slave trade in the Atlantic, the East African slave trade was increasing. It was missionary explorer Dr. David Livingston whose graphic descriptions brought the ravages of the East African slave trade to light. His missionary travels, his narratives of an expedition to Zambezi exposed the horrors of the slave trade. Two of the women had been shot the day before for attempting to untie their thongs. One woman had her infant's baby's brains knocked out because she couldn't carry her load and it. A man was dispatched with an axe because he had broken down with fatigue. Those taken out of a country are but a small section of the sufferers. We never realized the atrocious nature of the traffic until we saw it at its fountainhead. There truly Satan has a seat. Besides us actually captured, thousands are killed and die of their wounds and famine, driven from their villages by the internecine war waged for slaves with their own clansmen and neighbors, slain by the lust of gain, which is stimulated, be it remembered, always by the slave purchasers of Cuba and elsewhere. It was a trade in human misery. The British and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society reported most slaves are captured in the Lake Nyasa region of what today is Malawi and Mozambique, in the Barrel Gazelle region and in areas of Ethiopia. The slaves were taken to East African markets like Zanzibar, Kilwa, and Kiliman. Then they were shipped to Turkey, India, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, Iraq, Iran, and to the islands of Pemba, Reunion, and Madagascar. The anti-slavery reporter estimated the Muslim slave trade as exporting 63,000 slaves per year. Some estimates went as high as 500,000 slaves a year. This is a group of slave traders captured and their slaves and being brought to Zanzibar by the Royal Navy. One researcher, Ralph Austin, calculated that between 1830 and 1861, imports of slaves to the Persian Gulf estimated 3,400 per year. The same researcher noted that an average of 8,855 slaves a year were retained as slaves on the East African coasts of African slave masters. Few authors have dared to describe the horrors involved in the Trans-Sahara slave trade. Kidnapping and castrating young boys to be sold as eunuchs, the living dead, in the homes of wealthy Arab landlords. Forced marching young women across endless miles of scorching sand in the Sahara Desert to become slave concubines, most dying in transit. The Muslim slave trade typically dealt in the sale of castrated male slaves, eunuchs, who were created by completely amputating the scrotum and penis of 8 to 12-year-old African boys. Hundreds of thousands of them bled to death during this gory procedure. The survival rate from this process ranged from 1 in 10 to 1 in 30 survived. These castrate boys brought the highest price at a slave market. No Arab wanted any African in his home working on his plantation who was not castrated. They wanted eunuchs only. Sharia law. Islam's black slaves noted the Quran stipulated that female slaves might lawfully be enjoyed by their masters. That's a euphemism for rape. Muhammad himself owned many slaves, some of whom he captured in wars of conquest and some he purchased. The names of 40 slaves owned by Muhammad are recorded by Muslim chroniclers. Islamic law, Sharia law, contains elaborate regulations for slavery. A slave has no right to be heard in court. Testimony is forbidden by a slave. Slaves have no right to own property. Slaves can only marry with the permission of the owner. Slaves are considered chattel, that's movable property of the owner, just like cattle. Muslim slave owners were specifically entitled by Sharia law to sexually exploit the slaves, including hiring them out as prostitutes. Muhammad said that that's acceptable. One reason why very little has been written about Arab involvement in slavery is traditional Islamic culture still condones slavery. The Sharia, the codified Islamic law, which is based upon the teachings and example of Muhammad, contain explicit regulations for slavery. The whole point of Sharia is whatever Muhammad did is good, and is to be emulated. Whatever he did not do, we shouldn't do. Whatever he forbade, we must not do. How can you forbid pedophilia, rape, and slavery when Muhammad did those things? One of the great principles is following Muhammad's example. And he owned slaves, concubines. He traded in slaves, he owned slaves, he accumulated multiple wives. He even married a six-year-old, said he consummated the marriage only at age 9. He had concubines, slavery, sexual exploitation. He even allowed mass rape of female captured enemy. Muslim nations have engaged in the slave trade for over 600 years before the European nations came involved in the slave trade. And we could actually add, which were the creeps who got Europe involved in the slave trade? It was Charles V of Spain, who was the emperor before whom Martin Luther stood and said, "My conscience captive the word of God, here I stand, I can do no other." The emperor he defied. It was Emperor Charles V of Spain who authorized Spain's involvement in the slave trade. And why? Because Spain had suffered for 800 years under the Africans, under the Moors from Morocco, who had oppressed and exploited them. And so this was revenge. They were going to get back the Africans for what they had suffered. And so they learned slavery and abuse from their masters for 800 years, for 8 centuries. And so the Spanish led the charge, and the Portuguese who had suffered for centuries also. So Portugal and Spain led the slave exploits. And in Britain, it was Emperor Charles I, the man who was put on trial for treason and executed by Cromwell and Parliament of Britain. He was the one who authorized Britain's involvement in the slave trade. Cromwell and Parliament outlawed it, and Charles II got Britain back involved afterwards. But what about slavery today? It was the enemies of the Reformation who got Europe involved in the slave trade, and it's the reformers who ended European involvement in the slave trade. Today, there's still slavery. We've documented in Sudan. The Chinese are doing a lot of slavery. You look at what's going on in Chinese plantations in Africa. Over 200 years after the British outlawed the slave trade in 1807, slave raids and the sale of slaves in Muslim markets continues in countries like Sudan. We've got it on our films on Sudan, where people like Baroness Caroline Cox went with journalists into the slave markets, bought slaves and set them free. And then even gave money to journalists and said, go to the market, buy the slaves, of course, set them free afterwards, to prove to the journalists that slavery takes place in Sudan. It's been well documented. There are persistent, credible reports that slavery persists in Saudi Arabia, even that slaves from Sudan are ending up in Saudi Arabia. Recently, former slave from Nuba Mountains in Sudan, Mende Nazir, had her autobiography, Slave, My True Story, published. Mende was captured in 1992 in the Nuba Mountains. She is made a slave to a rich family in Khartoum, and then in 2002 to a Sudanese diplomat who took her to London. Imagine the audacity of taking your slave to London in the 21st century. She escaped. She sought political asylum. She's published a book, Slave, My True Story, pretty up to date. Although the Old Testament provided slavery for criminals and insolvent debtors, kidnapping and enslaving law-abiding people incurred the death penalty. Exodus 21:16, anyone who kidnaps another and sells him or has him when he is caught must be put to death. Slave trading, kidnapping for the slave trade, got you the death penalty under Old Testament law. When people say, but the Bible allows slavery, they must understand. The slavery allowed in the Bible was a criminal justice system for debtors and criminals, people who did property crimes, and it was for a limited period of time and had to be released after 7 years and so on. So it's not the same thing. And if you struck them so that they lost a tooth or an eye, then they had to be set free. You owned his labor, you did not own his body. And so what was tolerated in the Old Testament was for the criminal justice system, which is actually not as brutal as our prison system, where we put people who might be a fairly minor criminal in with major criminals and they get brutalized and they get cross-trained and they come out worse than they went in. Our prison system's worse than slavery. The New Testament expressly forbids both the slave trade and slavery itself. 1 Timothy 1:9 to 10. The law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for adulterers, for perverts, for slave traders, for liars and perjurers. So there, slave traders are smack in the middle of the worst scum of the earth. Galatians 3:28 says, neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, you're all one in Christ Jesus. You are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength, and you're to love your neighbor as yourself. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. Proclaim liberty throughout the land. So, all of this that I've given is found in our Slavery, Terrorism, and Islam book. Any questions, comments, complaints, or criticism? Slavery, the untold story. Questions? That's correct. Well, unfortunately, let's just take Darfur or Nuba Mountains. The Mujahideen, the Arab slavers, will come in, not so much on horseback, although that still happens, but often in four-wheel drive Toyotas with heavy 12.7 machine guns on the back, and they will kill a whole lot of people, grab them. They are, and the locals might have a bolt-action rifle, maybe. Some even have muskets. It's rare to find an automatic weapon amongst these average villagers, so they're outgunned. There is a bit of resistance. I know a place where the people have fought back with bows and arrows and hoes. So it's a very uneven situation. The slave raiders have some pretty good weaponry, and they come in, they surprise the people. They might even do it while the men are out in the fields. And so it's bad. There is resistance, of course, or there's attempted resistance. Boko Haram has done the same in northern Nigeria. They go in and they kidnapped a whole school. You know, these hundreds of girls who were kidnapped, and it's been a hard job getting back. I think most of them have now been rescued, but that's taken many traumatic years. So the Arabs are still kidnapping people. Yeah, and it's well documented. On here, we've got three different films on Sudan. We put in one DVD, and in the first one, Sudan Hidden Holocaust, 55 minutes, it's got Baroness Caroline Cox and others freeing slaves and seeing the slaves and the trading taking place. And it's just staggering that this can still be going on, 21st century. But the outrageous thing is that these politicians like Obama don't want to talk about it. I mean, how much courage does it take to walk up and kick a dead dog? And they want to kick dead dogs. You know, they're happy to condemn apartheid, colonialism, but they won't say anything about the present Islamic slave trade, the real threats of today, human trafficking in our own country, things like that. They won't deal with the real issues. They won't deal with meringue diamond mines, blood diamonds in Zimbabwe. That's real. Why deal with that? What's going on in the Congo? Let's rather just talk about things that ended centuries ago. Much safer. It's like having the courage to kick a dead dog. Any other comments or questions? Yes. What is our response? What do we do? Thank you. Perfect question. There are four eyes. I think the ideal thing is to look at the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah saw a great problem. When he heard about the problem that Jerusalem is in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire, he wept and he prayed. And then he researched and he got more information. And then he got more people involved. And then he mobilized the people. And they start to rebuild the walls. And the trumpeter was with him. And when one part of the wall was under attack, they'd sound the trumpet so all could come to mutual support. Basically, I put these in eyes. First eye is information. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. We need information. I've given some now. There's more on the table, more on our websites, more on the DVDs, getting on the email list. Get informed, number one. Number two, get interceding. We should pray as individuals. We should pray as families around a meal table. We should pray in our congregations or prayer groups, whether at work or at school or at college. Be informed, be interceding. Number three, get involved. There's always something we can do. We can write a letter to the newspaper. We can write a letter to a community paper. We can write a letter to a magazine. We can write a letter to our elected representative or the party we vote for in Parliament to speak out. We can write a letter to the embassy of the country where these things are taking place. We can protest. We can organise placard protests. I have organised and taken part in literally hundreds of placard protests on all sorts of things, especially pro-life, but a whole range all the way through to the evils going on in Zimbabwe, all the way through to human trafficking and those sort of things. Very important that we speak up. And I've seen captives set free because of pressure we've put to bear on governments where there were people being imprisoned and tortured. So we've seen good things happen. Get involved. And then network with others to get people also implementing a plan, strategy. When I started our work in Sudan in 1995, it didn't seem possible that Sudan could go free. And yet South Sudan is now independent of Sudan, which is an extraordinary achievement, which many people didn't believe was possible. And Mozambique, when I first started going in there in 1982, missionary work was illegal. Nobody under 18 was allowed to go into church. Mozambique was the least evangelized country in the Southern Hemisphere. There were not even 4% of Mozambique were Protestants in 1982. Today it's more like 34% would call themselves born-again evangelical Christians. Extraordinary in a country that was Catholic, with a lot of witchcraft, a lot of communism, a lot of Islam, and communist, where missionary work was illegal. We smuggled a lot of Bibles into Mozambique. We spoke up, did mobilization. So Operation Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah, how do you take a big task, information, intercession, involvement, implementation, investment? There's a whole range of strategies that's part of the Project Nehemiah and I Make a Difference book. We can all make a difference. We can all do something. Yes, sir. I could agree with you on those things. Globalization is indeed a great threat. As we spoke about first thing this morning, dealing with resisting Babylon the Beast, I do see globalization as a tremendous threat. And I agree with you. I believe Islam is crumbling. I don't believe it can survive freedom, can't survive scrutiny. Islam is crumbling, and I also agree what we're seeing with the violence is not Islam getting stronger. It's their desperation lashing out because they see they're losing the battle.
The evil one is
there. Exactly. What's gone on in Nigeria is well worth studying, because in Nigeria was for many years, decades, an Islamic country with they claimed to be an Islamic majority. They weren't, but they did have a Muslim government, that a succession of Muslim dictators, and Nigeria reached a stage where they can't even question it. Christians are the majority. And so the 12 northern states out of 36 states in Nigeria have Sharia law. They're persecuting Christians. The violence of Boko Haram, just to give you a statistic, between the year 2010 and the year 2015, in those 5 years, 1,000 churches were attacked by Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, with 17,000 Christians killed. Most of the churches attacked were majority Muslim background believers. The Muslims are losing the fight and they're lashing out with violence, but as our friend says, it's aggravating their problem because it's driving more Muslims away from Islam. Yes, there's a certain amount of terror and they achieve something short term, but long term, they're destroying people's whole sense of loyalty. For example, if you look at the Reformation, Bloody Mary, the Mary Tudor, who followed after her murdered brother, Edward VI, she, in her 5 years, brutalized the British people, tried to bludgeon them back to Rome after the Protestant Reformation had been taking off under her very young brother Edward. And she basically so disgusted the British people by the sight of aged British bishops being burned in the village square, like in Oxford, burning the Archbishop of Canterbury and Hooper and Ridley and others, the Bible translator John Rogers. It's just so disgusting that the Counter-Reformation entrenched in the British people their rejection of Catholicism. And so Bloody Mary, in her brutality, served the cause of the Reformation more than the cause of Catholicism, because they looked at it and said, if that's Catholicism, we don't want it. And to this day, it's illegal for a British monarch to be a Catholic and marry a Catholic because of that absolute horror of what happened. So, yes, I agree with you. I think globalism could easily be a bigger threat than Islam. And I do believe Islam is crumbling. Not that that doesn't mean they're a serious threat in the interim, but we're seeing, I think, the beginning of the end of Islam as a solid monolithic force. It's crumbling, but it's taking a lot of victims down with it. Make no mistake, we've got to know our enemy and be involved. But this is not the time to back away. This is the time to get involved in Muslim evangelism, because Muslims are disillusioned, confused, angry, frustrated, afraid. I mean, there's a whole lot of things. Quite right. Thank you, sir.